Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungain here, 0874848888 for your WhatsApps. If you're taking a break on a site, remember that number, 0874848888, because where we're turning to now is the issue of apprenticeships. Nicola, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Cullum, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thanks. I suppose let's get into the beginning of your son's experience with apprenticeships. Getting registered in the first place wasn't easy, but that eventually happened. So tell us what happened.
It did. Okay, so what we have is my son registered in, he's in his early 20s, and he is an apprentice plasterer. He registered in September of 2023, and unfortunately, through some errors in the system somewhere, that registration didn't go through, and we found out in September 2024 that he wasn't registered. So he was only registered a year later. So what I have now is a son who is stuck on phase one of seven phases for the past 2 years.
Okay. Now, so will you tell us, for anyone who doesn't know about how an apprenticeship is structured, some of the phases are done in practical learning on an active site, whether you're an electrician, a plumber, a plasterer, whatever. Some of your hours are learned in the practical part of your work. And then your other phases are off-site, known as off-site hours, or your college hours, effectively, your classroom-based hours.
Yes, yes. And the whole thing should take 4 years from registration through to your qualification. So my son has, he's currently stuck in phase one and waiting for phase two, which actually should be in college. Now, for the apprentice plasterers, that actually happens in Waterford. So the issue here is that he has, when he first registered, he was told he was going to be the only apprentice plasterer who had signed up in the entire country, and he had to wait for a group to be put together. So that's why we're waiting at least 6 months and then realised that he hadn't been registered at all. So what we're looking at is that he's stuck and isn't able to do phase two because of apparent budget restraints and budget constraints.
And the implications for him, if he can't do phase two, obviously he can't progress to the other stages as well. If he can't do phase two, and being stuck on phase one, apart from any other budget consideration, has financial implications for him.
Huge.
Tell us what they are.
The ramifications of this, are that he's actually stuck earning less than minimum wage for the past 2 years. Now, the very first year, he was on less than €5 an hour. Okay, and now he's on, say, it averages out to be about €9 an hour, which is less than minimum wage. And he's stuck on this at the moment. Now, it's a really physical job, and he works 80 hours a week. So he can't progress, do phase two, and move on to phase three, and then for his income to go up until he moves through the process. So the issue, I have actually contacted ETB and Sulis on his behalf.
That's the Education and Training Boards, the body that wear the Vocational Education Committees, the VECs in the counties. They're now called the ETBs, and they do post-leaving cert courses on the off-site hours for apprenticeships and the like, and further education.
Yes, exactly. So actually, when he registered again for the second time in September of last year, and in the January he got a call to say, can you start on Monday? Somebody had pulled out and he didn't have enough time to get himself together. We don't live in the same county as Waterford. So he needs accommodation. It's a full-time course accommodation and just wasn't enough time. So he said, look, he would take the next class if he was guaranteed that this wouldn't affect his overall length of time to be qualified. So he was told, yes, there is a course in May, which would be perfect. Okay. And he was all ready for that.
That gave him the time to organise his accommodation and his tools and start in May for the classroom-based phase. So what happened?
So what happened? No communication at all from the ETB or Sulis. So, of course, I made a call. What's happening? They said, oh, we can see here he's one of 17 others on the system waiting for this class to be released. But it's going to be July. So Kate contacted them in July, which was only last week, to be told that all of these classes have been deferred until at least January 2026.
January 2026.
Six. Yeah.
Right.
So we've no idea.
So the class he wasn't able to take part in took place in January 2025.
Did.
And then all subsequent classes
it.
Have been deferred after that date. So effectively there's a gap of a year for other aspiring plasterers to become
Absolutely.
To become qualified.
Yeah, exactly. So he is in September of this year, he'll be 2 years waiting to go to the college part of his course. So he's stuck, you know. So this is a kid who we said, you know, go and do something. You know, he didn't want to go down the whole college route. He was working in a job where he was earning probably 15, 16 euro an hour, but it wasn't going to get him a qualification. We were also saying, absolutely, get a piece of paper, get some qualifications. You can travel, you can do whatever. And so he said, okay, he would stop that job and go down to the 4 euro an hour he was, or 5 euro an hour.
It's an investment.
With the big picture. It's huge, you know, with the big picture that in 4 years, he'd have something decent to his name. And now he's turning around saying, Mum, I'm going to go to Australia.
Really?
Because there is no guarantee, there's no communication coming from Sulis that even to say there is something happening in January. You know, so like him...
He's concerned that it's going to be deferred again. And the four-year time frame he's been given on his apprenticeship is not going to come to pass. So effectively, an apprenticeship he expected to start in September 2023, which for whatever reason, the registration didn't go through and that, but at least September 2024, he thought he'd be out the gap by September 2028. He just doesn't see that happening now with phase two being deferred to January 2026 and a further, four or five phases to go on top of that.
Yeah. He will have three kind of college phases in total. So the thing is, but even that's not in writing. We don't know. So they might say January, or call back in February, call back in March. And it's very, you know, he sees his buddies, you know, working, doing great, able to run, you know, their cars and the whole lot. Now, he runs a van, he's to insure it and tax it and all that. But there's nothing left at the end of the week to have for a guy in his 20s who would want to have.
Because he's getting less than the minimum wage.
Less than minimum wage, yeah. It's very hard to survive on it, you know, and then we pushed him, saying, oh yeah, it'll all work out, it'll be 4 years, you'll have it all done and dusted, the same as if you'd maybe gone to university, and you will have a nice decent qualification with a job waiting for you. That was the whole point, that there'd be job ready, you know, and he was keen to run with that, you know, maybe set up his own business in time. But the bigger picture here is that, you know, there's a housing crisis. And even today, on the Today Show with Claire Byrne, I'm not sure who else was doing her show today.
Philip Boucher Hayes, they were talking about how the Construction Industry Federation says there are no labour issues in the construction industry, and you know that. Yeah. But there are people abroad going. If there isn't, what are we doing here? You have done most of you. You didn't. The first phone call you made, as you say, wasn't to lift the phone to Liveline. The first phone call you made was to get a bit of clarity on it. And you have been told what on the phone? It's your understanding that there is some budgetary issue that's causing the deferral of this.
Yes.
Is it?
So what I was told last week was there was budget constraints at the local level, and then Sulis HQ said there are no cuts. There's no constraints.
Yeah, well, our colleague Brian O'Donovan in the newsroom did a story on the RTÉ News website.
Yes.
The headline
is
SIPTU concerned over apprenticeship course deferrals. This is the trade union SIPTU, which represents a significant amount of people in the Construction Industry Federation, one of a number of unions there. But they had concerns that there was some issue about this as well. And a spokesperson for Sulis said that apprenticeship training had increased by 139%. In the last 5 years, no apprenticeship classes has been cancelled. That's not what you're saying. You're talking about deferrals.
No. Well, deferrals, that's what they're saying.
So, and Sulis and the, although this deferral now has in effect lasted a year, so the difference between cancellation and deferral may be in the eye of the beholder there. Sulis and the ETBs continue to work closely together to manage class scheduling for the remainder of the year. I'm quoting from the statement here, in line with available budgets.
Yes.
The apprenticeship system operates on a continuous intake basis, and a healthy pipeline of apprenticeship ready for training is required to ensure full workshops and classes. This number will continue to fluctuate throughout the year depending on registration times and scheduling on the classes. Although, interestingly, it does say there Solus and ETBs will continue to work closely to manage class scheduling in line with available budgets.
Yeah, so it does seem to come down to budgets. And I actually read that article myself last week. But again,
has your son got any official piece of paper, black and white correspondence saying, here's why this isn't going ahead? Or is it all on foot of you having to work the phones and get the answers verbally?
It's me. I make the call. What's happening? And they are saying, then this is what we're hearing. It's rumour. This is what we have been told. There's nothing black and white, nothing to say you are starting on this date and your next phase will be after this and the next phase after that. It's completely, and you're really untrustworthy. You don't know what's happening. It's completely disorganised.
Well, take a breath there, because I've literally just got a statement to hand. This is from the Department of Higher Education, Further and Higher Education, which is the government department that oversees third level education and apprenticeships and further education and training. Hang on, I'm just going to take a drink of water before I read this, because it's a lengthy statement. Take a drink yourself of water. Right. Through ongoing engagement between Solus and the Education and Training Boards, a funding pressure was identified for the 2025 apprenticeship budget. Ministers Lawless and Harkin, that's James Lawless, the Fianna Fáil TD for Kildare North, and Marian Harkin, Independent TD for Sligo Leitrim, who are the ministers in the department, directed Solus to ensure that no existing apprenticeship classes would be cancelled as this issue was worked through. A resolution has been found, and Minister Lawless has prioritised resources to meet this pressure in 2025. Although it should be noted, in your case, the class that your son wants to go into has been deferred until January 2026. Anyway, back to the statement. Yeah. Solus has worked closely with the ETBs to complete detailed scheduling for the remainder of the year. The work is now complete, and Solus has been instructed to confirm final apprenticeship funding allocations with ETBs without delay, enabling them to proceed with scheduling and delivery. The apprenticeship system operates on a continuous intake basis, and a healthy pipeline of apprentices ready for training is required to ensure full workshops and classes, ETBs scheduling apprenticeship classes on a rolling basis over the course of the year. Craft apprenticeships have grown significantly in recent years, with annual registrations increasing by 35% since 2019, from 5,271 in 2019 to 7,113 in 2024. The number of craft apprenticeship reached 25,000 at the end of 2024, up from 16,000 in 2019. This has been supported by significant government investment. The growth is welcome and necessary, given the vital role apprentices play in supporting the construction sector and delivering key government priorities, such as housing, retrofitting, infrastructure and development. Now, what's not in that statement, it strikes me, is that the number of registrations, which is not where the issue is. Registration is one thing, getting your off-site and college hours and all of that is where the pinch point arrives in your case and the case of many others. That's jumped by somewhere in the region of 900 from 2019 to 2024, and the number of craft apprentices has jumped by 9,000 from 2019 to the end of 2024. It says it's supported by significant government investment, but it's not quite clear whether or not that has been a proportionate investment with the number of people who are actually signing up to that. So I suppose, as the fella says, are you any the wiser?
No, because that language is really similar to the article that Brian O'Donovan wrote. So it's like they've nearly rehashed, obviously, the stuff they've already put out, you know, and they're saying classes have not been cancelled, but not cancelled is not the same as not deferred. So they can keep pushing things out and saying, oh, we're doing great things, not cancelling, but there's no kids being educated.
Yeah, and if there was one in January and then there was supposed to have been one in May and there was supposed to have been one in July and they did not happen in 2025 and are happening in 2026, whether they're cancelled or deferred, do you feel this is kind of semantics, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the thing is, if they're not contacting the youngsters themselves to say this is the plan, it's like, you know, just we'll wing it. Just, you know, keep them working away. Just let them not, you know, raise any issues here. And, you know, unless somebody actually fights it and says what's happening and pushes for it, they're going to be forgotten about. And then you have, you know, kids like my son who's going to say, I'm not waiting around any longer and I'm going.
And as you say, look, he didn't want to go down the college route, but in a parallel universe where he had gone down the college route, he'd have been told, you're starting your degree course in September 2023. It's a three-year degree course. Yeah. Year runs from September to June. And in those 3 years, he'll complete his coursework, do his exams, and he'll be out the other side based on merit, and he'll get his degree and he'll be fully qualified. He doesn't have that firm timeline commitment with a schedule of classes as to when he'll be finished, completed, fully qualified and able, as you say, to set up his own business or sign off on jobs or anything else if he's working for a larger construction company.
Yeah, exactly. And even his employer is quite frustrated because he wants them to be getting, obviously, the, you know, the college support, and the employer has paid into the system financially, you know, to support the funding. So he's kind of going, where's my money? Where's all my money gone?
Sure, but you mean, at the same time, and I'm not saying in the case of your son's employer, at the same time, it's undeniable that there are people now working on sites for less than the minimum wage who are effectively highly skilled labourers who are waiting to become qualified, but not enjoying any of the advantage of a labourer who's not in the apprenticeship system, who could be paid the minimum wage on day one.
You absolutely, but you kind of take that hit because you're training. So because, you know, because my son won't be paying for any essential college fees, you kind of go, well, that's kind of been taken out of your wages as you're going along because you've been paid less. That was how we kind of sold it to him at the time. But even then, that doesn't seem to be coming to fruition now. It's taken such a long time. I mean, it's his 2 years in September and he has only one phase of seven done. So it's crazy.
And what would be his plan if he goes to Australia?
Well, that was in the heat of the moment yesterday when he found out about the deferment again. He said, oh, I'm better off in Australia. I've got friends there. They're earning great money and having a life. And he says, I'm earning terrible money. And if you don't have money in this country, you can't do things. So he's looking at his friends in a different way. So, I'm hoping something gets resolved.
And in a nutshell, he needs clarity and preferably a clear pathway to him qualifying within 4 years with definitive dates on when the classes he needs are going to take place. It seems from what you're saying, it'd do a lot for his stress levels and his morale and his career planning.
Absolutely, he's completely despondent. You know, he needs security. This is happening. Get on with my life and, you know, just have a plan. But it's really awful. And it's not just him. It's all the other men and women or boys and girls in this same group. And then obviously the housing crisis that we have, it's kind of really you're calling out and crying out for tradesmen and women and you're not educating them. So I don't know where we are really.
Fergal O'Connell, good afternoon to you.
How are you doing, sir?
Good, thanks. You're listening to Nicola there. You're not shocked by what she has to say.
No, this is a common, this is going on for years. I mean, it's taken an apprenticeship plumber, electrician, carpenter, 6 years because of these delays, and it should be 4 year apprenticeship. This has gone on years. Like Minister Harris at the time, when he was in Port of Education, was telling young people not to go to college, take up apprenticeships. But what they haven't done is they haven't put extra tutors in place in the ETBs. So that's where the backlash, that's why there's a delay.
And so the people who would be tutoring in the education and training boards would be qualified plasterers, plumbers, bricklayers, whatever else. And with training, they become an instructor on the courses. What's the issue there? Is it that they can't get people to leave sites to become instructors, or is there just not a pipeline in place to train them up to become trainers?
There is no new trainer seemingly coming on board, but there's only X amount of classrooms around the country, and they're constantly full. So there's no extra tutors or no extra classrooms. So the backlog will always continue, and it has been for the last couple of years.
So when you hear those figures of annual registrations up by 35% and the number of craft apprentices going from 16,000 to 25,000 in 5 years, your concern when you hear that is that apprentice registrations going up by 35% is one thing, but unless tutors go up by 35% in line with that, and more classrooms are opened up, they're not going to get their qualifications in 4 years. That'd be your concern, is it?
But that's what's happening, and that has been happening for the last couple of years. And even the Solus and the further, the higher education statements, not one part of them statement said that there was extra trainers put in place or tutors or anything. They're all on about funding. But the fact of the matter is, this is right across the country.
And you're in construction yourself, are you?
I was, but this is ongoing. This has been going on for the last couple of years. If you ask anybody, this is nothing new. And as Scott Warson's, when the state took a big advertisement, they don't go to college, do apprenticeships.
Right. The demand for apprenticeships went up. And look, obviously, there is a lot of building in the country. We've gone from when the boom collapsed the industry and college applications for building and construction related courses went through the floor. Do you think the ETB's ever recovered from that with the fall away in people wanting to get into construction, with the collapse in investment into building, do you think it ever recovered from that phase, that fall off back in the early 2010s?
Well, whatever, if they did or didn't, what they shouldn't have done is advise young people to go into apprenticeship if they didn't have the people in place to do it.
Right.
You mean that's what the minister said at the time. Do not go to college. Do apprenticeships.
Mm.
And then you hear that woman out on stuck. You know what I mean? Because when you do your apprenticeship, year one, at the end of it, you do a test. Then you go on to year two if you pass it. And so forth, up to fourth year. But there's young lads I know from people I know, electricians. They have two-year apprenticeships candidates with them, but they're only being paid second year because they can't pass out.
Mm. And if you can't, if you're not qualified, you can't sign off on a job. So things get held up. You have a bigger burden on qualified electricians having to come off and sign off on jobs on sites, because the unqualified electrician clearly can't sign off on a job on a site and say this is done and completed to the adequate standard.
Yeah, but the evidence are not going to affect from what happens in the ETBs. And but they're saying there's a shortage of money and this, that, and the other. Well, why is all the classrooms full? And if I can assure you, or the year was asked Solus how many, or ETBs, how many new trainers have been taken on in the education training boards, and how many extra classrooms have came online or came on for all this new apprenticeships that's candidates that came forward.
Okay, well, we will ask them that on air now. How many new instructors and how many new training places and new classrooms? How has the capacity of the system increased over time in the same time frame, 2019 to 2024, in line with the other figures they've given us? And what money has been provided to the ETBs and maybe the whole time equivalent for an instructor for what that money would have paid for? That's the kind of detail that you say is required, yeah?
Yeah, but the question would have to be put to in relation to construction, because there's apprenticeships in all other categories.
That's true. It's been expanded out. So craft apprenticeships is really what we're looking for. How many new training places have been provided for craft apprenticeship? What budget has been given for that? And what is that equivalent to in whole time equivalents for instructors to meet the increased demand of 35% in registrations and the extra, 6,000 craft apprentices that are in play between 2019 and 2024. Okay, consider it formally asked, Fergal. We make that request on air now to whoever the competent authority is, whether that's the Department of Further and Higher Education, the ETB or Solus. We'd welcome an answer before we come off air at 3 o'clock. Noel Larkin, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
Good afternoon. Give us your insight into it. Are you surprised by Nicola's son's predicament as he's stuck in phase one?
No, I'm not. We're in the engineering game. Three of our apprentices have left the system because they couldn't move as a step forward.
And what line were they in?
Yeah. The fitters and welder fabricators. And if what you do is you take on the apprentice for the first year, you do a couple of months of training, in-house training, and then they go to a ETB training centre for 9 months, come back onto the job again, do a year with you, so you're actually gone up to second year at that stage, and then you have to go to college for 3 months to move another step, but no college places available. Apprentices waiting, when they should be finished serving their time, they're still waiting for their first college place and none available.
And can they do their practical training in a block, you know, do phase one, and then can they get all of that out of the way, or is it better from the employer's point of view, obviously, where they do really, the practice, do the theory, come back, and then, you know, alternate between the two? I mean, from your point of view in training, what's better?
That's the ideal. So that you, if you were in your second year and you're trained in the physical side of it, and you want to go to the educational side of it, then so you get those exams out of the way and you move on another step then again. And, you know, it's a 4-year apprenticeship. You should have two college places done by the time you finish your time and you get signed off then as a fully qualified person.
And how long has it taken in your experience then, Noel? I mean, it's supposed to be 4 years. In the case of three or four of your apprenticeships, you say, fitters, welder, fabricators, it just got too much for them. Tell us, first of all, how long for the guys who've stayed the pace and been prepared to put up with this, how long is qualification really taking?
Yeah. 3 years is the limit. Once an apprentice is not, as the person, the previous speaker said, the money goes up as you progress in your years.
Right.
And if an apprentice is in his third year, now a lot of employers, including myself, up the wages in the hope that these college places had come on board. But then they weren't. So the guys.
So go on, finish that sentence there. You were saying if an apprentice is in his third year, finish that sentence. What were you going to say?
If he doesn't, if he hasn't got his college place, then they get fed up waiting around. And so that's it. And the three that I had are gone to Australia.
Australia, right.
Didn't finish their time. I've been so close, like another year would have finished their apprenticeship and they'd be a qualified person and they could go anywhere in the world with that qualification then in their pocket.
And what are they doing in Australia?
Oh, I'm not sure. I haven't kept in contact with them, or they haven't kept in contact with me, but I'm sure they're on sites or whatever.
Right. But they just got frustrated.
I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that, Colin. Yeah, so it's very frustrating. And I was a member of the Galway and Roscommon Education Board for 5 years. And we fought this case hard from the inside, trying to get college places available.
And what was the response?
None. There's just the usual that you got there earlier, you know, that they're going to try and get funds in place to move this forward. Years on, it still hasn't moved forward.
And what kind of years are you talking about, Noel? I mean, because a big issue in this, and that one that was, you know, on programmes I've worked on before where there's been a bit of discussion about this, there was a level of saying, well, COVID intervened and that's why there was a backlog and the backlog has been cleared. In your experience, how long has there been under capacity for instruction in the system based on your experience in Galway and Roscommon?
There's 10 years there and COVID certainly didn't help the situation.
Right, but it's not the cause in your experience.
No, it's not the cause. It's not the cause. Like, to be fair to the GRETB, the Galway and Roscommon Education and Training Board, in Merview in Galway, like a brand new centre was opened for the physical training, the mechanical training of plumbers and electricians, which is a great centre. I mean, it's going to take on a lot of new apprentices. But if the college places are not available, it's a waste of space.
When you say if the college places, if it's not staffed up to instruct people and make full use of it, is that what you mean?
Yeah. No, like you have to go to, it's the ATU here in Galway now, but there are other places in Sligo and Roscommon where you go. It's like a college where you go and you do all your paperwork and you do your exam at the end.
Okay.
To get the first part of your training. So it's part of the course is 2-3 month terms away in a college, and you do all your education of it. In it's basically known it in theory as well as in practice.
And as an employer, Noel, where does that leave you? I mean, you've planned to have three or four qualified fellas, fitters, welder, fabricators, come out the other side, and you kind of think, well, that there's those gaps filled and maybe we'll be able to take on project X or Y at the end of that period with increased capacity in the company. And then end of year three, the lads say, look, our courses are being deferred. We're not getting finished here. With the best will in the world, Nolan, nothing against yourself, we're off to Australia. I mean, what do you do then? Take on new apprenticeships and start all apprentices and start all over again?
No, I haven't taken on a new apprentice in the last few years now because because the situation hasn't been resolved. And if a young person comes in looking for an apprenticeship, I would say, look, I can't guarantee you that you're going to get your college place to get the theory in place here. I would certainly take you on, but it is a risk now. And most young people won't take that risk. So, and I can't blame them. They start on very small money for the first year, you know, and then like the money has to increase over the four-year period. And then you're on qualified person's wages at the end of that. And like, if an apprentice is going to start off on low money, there has to be a gain at the end for them.
Can I just ask, for an apprentice to register, Noel, do they have to have your agreement to be taken on by you? So it's not
a
case that
they find an employer.
Yeah, so you can't say to somebody, look, I'll take you on if you can guarantee me you're going to get your college place, because they have to be registered with you to be able to apply for the college place. All right.
That's all up to the employer. If you take on an apprentice, you have to register with the ETB to register your apprentice, and then they're in the system and it starts rolling from there.
Anyway, you're done with taking people on until this situation is resolved.
At the moment.
You just can't
do it.
At the
moment.
Okay. All right, thanks,
Noel. I came through the apprenticeship scheme myself, and I would love to keep training young apprentices coming through. Like, and I came through the apprenticeship, as I said, like, and I opened up my own business, like, and now we have 35 people working, like, you know.
Mm.
That's there for other apprentices coming along the way as well. And it's a shame that the government just doesn't look at this in a way that they should be looking at it. Like, if they're encouraging apprentices and apprenticeships, then they have to have the system in place.
Okay, and as you know,
and at the moment they don't.
Okay, and you heard, you know, the questions Fergal raised, and we did put out the call to get those answers. So hopefully we'll get clarity on that. But as it stands at the moment, in your estimation, Noel, things are not where they should be. Tom O'Hearn, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
I'm not too bad now. What field are you in?
I'm in calibration, so I'm a calibration technician. It's its own standalone apprenticeship.
Okay.
And we would feed into basically pharmaceutical, it'd be the big one, and then you also med device and petrochemical and stuff like that if we're working offshore.
Right, so pretty specialist skills.
They would be, yeah. We would have an overlap, I think, with some of the electrical stuff, you know, but it is specialist stuff.
Okay, so kind of electrical and engineering, broadly speaking, would that be fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's your experience? Are you experienced with having done an apprenticeship or taking on apprenticeships, and how's it gone for you?
Both. I've done my apprenticeship with FOSS when I did it, and then working for the company that I'm working for, we have our own apprenticeships that we bring through internally, and I am actually signed off as an assessor within Sullis, so they have to do certain amount of training on the sites before then they go in for the specific phases that yourself and Fergal and Noel were talking about.
Right.
I'm actually one of those assessors, so I've had maybe anywhere between 7 or 8 lads that have kind of come through. I wouldn't have them all the time, but they'd come through to me, and then basically it's on the job training, so you need to show them, and that they have to be competent. A lot of our work is based on following procedures, you know, set up, safety, assessing the area, you know, making sure that all of the energy sources are isolated before you start loosening whatever it is you're going to be working on. So, and then subsequently, as I've aged out, I have been approached to go to one of the ETBs as an instructor. And I thought they were having a laugh when they told me how much it's less than what it's less than half of what I'm earning in the industry now. And I wouldn't be, like, I'm not an engineer. I'm a technician. So I'm not on engineer's money. But
so you can see why it's difficult to attract people into being an instructor when somebody
absolutely
is earning twice in industry what they're going to be earning as an instructor.
Yeah. The only way I could see it, and this is the experience of having talking to guys in the that are instructors, is they're people that have their own company and they're doing this out of the love of the trade. So he might be an electrical contractor. He's got a good team of lads working for them and he's doing this on the side. He's pretty much, you know, he's mid-50s. He's pulling back off the tools. The business is running itself and he's doing this to kind of keep the day ticking over for him.
Okay.
There's a couple of guys I know that are like that. They're in it for the love.
Do you have any ballpark figure for, you know, what apprentices in your area or how long it's taking them to get through and qualify? Because if it's a specialist area, and as you say, there's only a few lads, does it take a while before there are classroom hours available or it's worthwhile putting on classroom training for people if there are fewer of them?
It's hard to give you a number because obviously, as the lads mentioned, COVID was very disruptive. But on average, they're getting through 5.5 years. You know, that's provided they don't fail an exam and they get kicked back.
Okay.
With that,
and it should be four. But should it standard apprenticeship time?
It should be four standard apprentice. Yeah, you basically work through your phases, and the way it is you do the initial phase two in one of the training centres, and then you're going to be based in one of the universities, whether it's Cork. Carlow is the main one that we would be sent to for the, because I think that's the only place to do the instrumentation and calibration courses, is Carlow. But I know there's talk about Cork maybe bringing on board and Sligo and, you know, with other lecturers. They're lecturers. They are not the guys that I'm talking about where we're going into the ETBs. Basically, you get the guys off the ground and get them up as the initial instructors. When you're dealing with universities, they're lecturers. They're on lecturers' money. They would have, you know, the requirements to have all of the paperwork behind them.
In your estimation, improving the incentives to go in and be a practical instructor would help.
Absolutely, because it would speed guys through, and that's all about it is making sure that we're getting quality guys out. I mean, I've got, you know, the numerous lads that I've gone through. They're working in America, they're working in Sweden, they're working in Belgium, they're working in Holland, because we've got the language and we've got the technology know-how, and they get great experience here. Like, I've got techs now with me that have gone through, they've worked in med device, pharmaceutical, biomed and semiconductor, and we're also involved in commissioning data centres.
Right. So this isn't just a construction thing, you know, for the apprenticeship thing. This is key to Ireland's offering for foreign direct investment, basically, that you have people with these core skills.
Absolutely. Yes. If you talk about all this foreign direct investment, there's a calibration technician there. If you've got a piece of equipment that you're relying for your process, how do you know it's reading correctly? You have a calibration certificate, and then that we're the backup behind that.
So do you think there's a kind of a logic of looking at that, the what they call the windfall tax gains from foreign direct investment from these very sectors, and ring fencing some of that money to put into training in this area to improve that offering, whether it's in craft apprenticeships to build the infrastructure that's necessary, or for these specialist skills that you have an insight into?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And like, it's like, if you go to the big sites when they're building it, all the other trades are there. Like, we're beside them, wet mechanical guys, we're beside carpenters, we're beside all of the trades, you know, and like we're all gears and a gearbox to keep the machine rolling. And like, if you don't invest in it and you keep investing it, like, you know, the lads are aging out, you know, or what's happened to a lot of our guys have come through, they've become engineers and they've gone into management roles. So they're not even on the tools anymore. So you're actually losing them through multiple forms of attrition. And then obviously, as Noel said, you've lads going to Australia, you know, Canada, America, you know, they'll go where the work is.
And that time frame, the delay issue seems to be common across them. Look, Tom, thanks very much for that. And indeed to Noel and Fergal and Nicole before that as well. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute. 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps. Dr. Juan Trujillo, welcome to Liveline.
Hello, Colin. Thank you so much for pronouncing it quite well.
Thanks very much. I'll keep working on it. But anyway, I hope it's as good as can be expected. Tell me about the program you're running in Cork University Hospital and who it's aimed at.
Well, so the people now must know, I'm a pediatric allergist. I work in Cork University Hospital and University College of Cork. And we have a pediatric allergy service that we have started, a dedicated oral immunotherapy clinic that is attached to our other allergy services that we are doing.
So what is an oral immunotherapy clinic for people who have, in this case, is it tree nut allergies?
Thank you for asking. So oral immunotherapy is it's not that new, but it's actually quite recently rediscovered in the last 10 to 15 years of a way to introduce food into patients that are allergic to one specific culprit food. In this case, if you're allergic to peanuts, you could introduce slowly doses of peanut in a specific amount of time to maintain or to decrease the allergic reactions in the future.
So you're starting off basically with micro doses of peanuts and building it up in a supervised environment so that if there's any allergic reaction, there's medical staff on standby to try and react to that. Is that a fair summary of what it is you do?
Yes, you start up dosing it and then you maintain the dose at home until you get to an adequate dose. But it sounds easier than it is, because with those type of treatments, you could have reactions. But the idea and the outcome of this treatment at the end is to have less allergic accidental exposures at home or in other places, and then having a better quality of life for the patient.
And can people largely live, you know, after going through oral immunotherapy and having exposure to what has caused them the severe allergic reaction, how much of a normal life can people lead? Could they go and consume larger amounts of this, or does it only protect them against small trace amounts that might accidentally end up in their food?
That will be entirely depending on what the body will react. Some people, this could have a success rate of 80%. Some people, of 10 people, 8 will actually succeed to increase their doses or to just avoid it in normal times. And then when they encounter with an accidental traces of the allergen, they won't have a reaction. In other people, they could actually eat properly without any problems. And in other people, even this oral immunotherapy, it won't work and they will continue to have reactions.
Okay, so the people you are running it for is children between 0 and 5 years of age. And your hope is that there'll be a variety of successful outcomes with these children between 0 and 5 years of age, but that at least after the age of 5, they may be able to live with less fear in their lives when it comes to coming into contact with food outside the very controlled environment of the home. Is that the hope?
Yes, that's correct. And it's especially important for children than for older people, because let's say that you have a 7, 8, or even a 11 or 12-year-old person, they already have their mindset of what they don't like and what they like. So yes, you can do oral immunotherapy in older people, but the success rate and the outcome is better when you're younger, because it's easier for your mentality to change and the way of your habits to eat to change.
So is this is just in Cork, though? This is not a nationwide program that's rolled out in all hospitals?
So one of the things that I don't know about the other hospitals in this case, but what I will tell you is that we have been being an allergy center even before I came here. One of the most top leading allergies of the world was actually leading this hospital, and I have to fit those shoes. So this is actually an extra effort that we're trying to do, because people were actually coming from different places of UK, Brazil, France, Spain, doing this oral immunotherapy, Irish people going to those places. And I wasn't feeling that wasn't correct, that they were not having this kind of procedure here.
Okay, which is a huge cost, is it? I mean, to go, it's not cheap to go to Brazil and get therapy like this.
if you're Brazilian, it's less cheap, but it's less costly. But they usually go to other places that they can actually acquire this immunotherapy. And just for you to know, allergy and Ireland are really well connected. We have the top research, one of the top researchers here, and we have a lot of investigation about it. So we shouldn't be just delaying what other people are doing in other parts of the world.
Okay. Now, this is not, you know, you're not here advocating for the reclassification of or the licensing of a particular drug in Ireland. This is a non-drug based treatment that you're running out of the centre, and it's, you know, aimed at families, children who, as one parent has put it to me, you know, that there is fear every day associated with snacks, meals, kissing, even in later life, drinking drinks, these kind of things, that, you know, you're trying to remove the anxiety of this without an expensive drug-based treatment administered in early life.
Yes, that is correct. And just for be clear about this, I haven't invented the wheel here. So this was a training that we have been doing for several years. Myself, as a person that was trained in Spain, they have been doing this for forever. And we went with our team to different places, France, Spain, and also contact people from Canada to help us build this with the usual products that you can actually buy from the stores.
Okay, so products with a small amount of, say, peanut in them, snack
yes.
products and the like. But the centre that you're running between Cork University Hospital and UCC, the University College Cork Centre of Excellence in Allergy, it's the HSE, we asked for a statement on this, you know, asking why it isn't a standard national issue rather than, I suppose, I wouldn't call it a pilot program where you are, but, you know, an internal program of the Cork University Hospital and UCC. They say the HSE recognises the difficulties experienced by children with allergies and the challenges faced by their families. The HSE welcomes this development at Cork University Hospital, which will make a difference for young children affected by allergies, and continues to work with paediatric services to further develop Ireland's allergy services for children. Where would you say the state of play is with allergy services for children?
I will say that I've been here 6 years, and we were 3 pediatric allergies when I came to this country. So now we are actually increasing more and more in different areas. And it is difficult to make the changes that we want to change until we get different support. But I will say that Cork University Hospital and UCC have gave me a lot of support to get what I can right now. But it's also making an extra effort in our own work.
Okay.
This is not like a clinic that actually is going to replace another clinic. We are doing an extra clinic to help them, because kids need this essentially.
Okay. All right, and just on this, the funding of the work you're doing at the moment is not HSE funding, is it? This is something that you're allocating to internally in the budgets of UCC and Cork University Hospital.
This is extra free hours that we don't have, but that we need to deserve it. No, we don't have that from the
okay.
HSE funding, especially from this.
Okay, Christine, you've been listening to this. What's your situation?
Good afternoon, Colm, and thanks a million for having me on the show. This is a huge breakthrough for Irish allergy sufferers in the country, and I know I'm not alone in extending my gratitude to the paediatric allergy team in Cork who've launched this programme. It's the first of its kind in Ireland, and it's going to make such a huge difference to these kids and their families and their extended families. As grateful as I am to see this programme introduced, it's a drop in the ocean with treating Irish allergies, you know, with the scale of it. I know that I read in the examiner during the week that I think it's 30 patients are currently under the programme, with looking to scale up to 2027, that there'd be 170 to 200 patients being brought into the programme annually. Just to kind of give some context on that, there is 20,000 or over 20,000 children in Ireland with peanut allergy alone. You know, if you're to consider other food allergies, tree nut allergies, milk allergies, etc., it is fair to say that it's multiples of that figure. So at the moment, you know, you're looking at a really small amount, and it's groundbreaking, and it's you know, Dr. Trugolo and his team are showing us that it can be done. So really, I suppose I'm calling on the HSE to extend this programme, to extend it nationally, also to extend the age group. You know, currently it's under children under five, and you know,
that's which rules you out? I mean, tell us. Tell us about
your rules me out. Absolutely, yeah. My son Ryan is 12. He was diagnosed with his allergies. He was over five, so he was six. So he wasn't born with his allergies. He actually developed them. So we are based in Cork. So this program is running down the road from us, but we can't access it. So we're in a situation, Ryan is allergic to peanut and cashew nut. And if we want to get treatment, the only option for us is to travel abroad.
Right. Have you ever researched that? I mean, what type of costs are you talking about there? And what kind of a time commitment even would you be looking at if you're, you know, parents taking time out of work or whatever?
You know?
Yeah, give us tell us what it would be.
It's huge. So for peanut alone, to access Palforzia in the UK, it's 18,000 to participate in the programme.
This is the drug.
And then you're looking at
this is a drug.
This is that's the drug. Yeah, so this is a drug, and you know, oral immunotherapy is a little bit cheaper than that, but it's still, you're talking about thousands. And if you've multiple allergies, you're talking tens of thousands. And that's also then you're looking at, and you know, as a parent, you're looking at time off work, your child's taking time off work. You're also looking at getting on a flight. So you're booking all your flights, but you're updosing your child, and you're getting on a flight home and hoping that their reaction, or that they're safe to travel during that time frame. And if they have any adverse reactions, then you are a flight away from, you know, your consultant who's over in the UK or Belfast. I know people travel to France and many different countries. So it's really not ideal. And we have huge, you know, Dr. Trullo spoke about, like, in Ireland, we've top researchers. There is no reason that I can see that we shouldn't be on par with our European countries and the UK with the delivery of therapies for allergy sufferers.
And what is the impact day to day like for Ryan? I mean, what kind of prep does he have to do going out? How cautious does he have to be, you know, say going over to a friend's house, you know, advising parents about eating? How nervous would he be around food and the like?
It's life changing, you know, and it's hard to know with him what, you know, what way he would have been without these allergies. But, you know, for him, even as a small boy going to birthday parties, he can't eat the cake. So, you know, what we learned to do was I when he was small, I used to stay at the parties with him. You know, no kid really wants their mum at their birthday parties, you know, at other kids' birthday parties. If he goes on a play date, I have to train the mom or the dad or who's ever minding the kids, I have to train them how to use an EpiPen, which is really frightening for some parents who aren't used to allergies. And it's very off-putting for a parent. You know, they know that if Ryan is coming over, they might be in this situation. So, you know,
Has it been isolating for him as a result of people, do you think, maybe just kind of erred on the side of,
very,
you know what,
so
let's only have one person over on the play date rather than three or two because I don't really want to get into an emergency situation that's going to require me administering an EpiPen.
Exactly. And it's hard to quantify that, but really, you know, sleepovers, and you name it, you know, a couple of his buddies going down to play soccer in the, you know, in the green where we live, you know, really it's difficult for him to kind of do that. He's also, you know, you're looking at, albeit as life-saving as EpiPens are, it's an injection. It's very frightening for a child to inject themselves. And that thought, you know, so the allergy itself is hugely frightening and life-threatening, you know.
Well, you must carry a fair bit of fear yourself then.
100%. It's very difficult. It's very frightening as a mom, you know. And it's changed our lives. It's changed his life most significantly. But even that of his siblings, it's a very different life, you know. Ryan is the first in our greater family to have allergies and to have serious allergies. And it's something that I wasn't used to. I've learned a huge amount along the way, but it's very frightening.
And would the oral immunotherapy that's been offered in Cork at the moment, you know, would it be suitable for somebody of Ryan's age? He's 12, they're administering between 0 and 5. If they were to expand the age range, could he benefit from it?
Absolutely. You know, like, obviously there's no guarantee the treatment suits some children more than others. But I believe that, it would benefit him. Okay. I believe that it would eliminate the risk. You know, when Brian is 12 now, you know, he's going to be heading to secondary school soon. I'll have less control over, you know, his social interactions. You know, he's going to be going out to discos. You mentioned kissing, all of that. It would give me a huge peace of mind to know that he could tolerate a small, it would just eliminate that accidental right. exposure piece, which could kill him.
Which is, I mean, you know, so, which is a very tough reality for you all to be living with day to day.
It is. And, you know, kind of the metric, you know, kind of I'm a reasonable person and, you know, I know the HSE is totally overstretched and all the rest. But I suppose the economic, you know, metrics that they use to evaluate, you know, often it's, you know, looking at the cost of, you know, living with an illness or treating or the cost of the treatment of an illness. But with allergic children, they're not ill children, so they don't use much HSE. They don't use much health service resources. They're not inpatients in hospital when they're well. But if they encounter their allergen, it is kind of catastrophic consequences. So, like, I believe that the metrics used to evaluate these services aren't appropriate for allergy children.
Okay. Dr. Juan Trujillo, the possibility of this being widened to people like Ryan, you know, a 12-year-old with a nut allergy, is that on the horizon at the moment? How soon could that happen if the resources were there?
How soon could it happen if the resources are there? Well, the resources also are infrastructure and everything. I think, like in anything, if we're going to start something, we have to go step by step so that we don't miss or have mistakes. Okay. And sadly, during those steps, you will actually miss the age gap of some people. And that's actually quite bad. But to be prepared, you have to do it slowly until you get to that phase. That's why we wouldn't be able to provide it so far, but I'm hoping that it will be starting in the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years that we can say that everyone have the chance to get it.
Okay. All right, Dr. Juan Trujillo from Cork University Hospital and University College Cork Centre of Excellence for Allergies, and Christine, mother of Ryan, who is still waiting for clarity as to when her son could avail of it. Thanks very much to you both. We'll be back in a minute. Now, on Wednesday, we were contacted by Tony. Tony is Aoife's father. Aoife has an intellectual disability. Tony's getting older, and himself and his wife are concerned about what will happen after they die and what services will be in place for their daughter, because, you know, she needs a residential service. She needs the level of care and her needs catered for to the standard and the level that they've been providing so far. And they have got no clarity from anybody who's responsible for providing services as to what kind of residential care might be in place. We've been contacted by numerous parents since Marie yesterday talking about her situation and several others as well. Now, we were contacted by Una, and Una, unfortunately, is undergoing treatment for a terminal illness, as you'll hear in a moment. So she couldn't have a call with us today. She was concerned about the impact of pain medication on her and her ability to have a conversation live on air, but she was very keen to give us an insight into her situation and how much Tony and Marie and all of the others, Frank as well, how their situation chimed with her as she was listening. Marie said yesterday she felt that parents like her were a forgotten people. And here's what Una had to say to us. We got this Una's message recorded by a colleague here in the office because Una, as I say, unfortunately was not able to speak to us today. Here's what she had to say.
Over the past few days, I've been listening to parents on Liveline talking about a situation which resonates deeply with me. They want to know what will happen to their children with special needs when they die. I'm a 72-year-old widow whose only child, a 30-year-old son, has Down syndrome. Since the day my son was born, we were fighting for him. Fighting to get him into school, fighting every step of the way, fighting to get him what he's entitled to. Now, I have a different fight on my hands as I've been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I'm in a lot of pain because the cancer has spread. I'm on a lot of pain medication and I attend the hospice often. This is all very difficult for my son to take in. His father died suddenly, and I can see him looking at me and putting two and two together. He understands that I'm very sick. I have to tell him that I might not get better and that the doctors are trying to help me with the pain. My son is worried. I have not applied for residential housing for him. I would not want to see him end up in a nursing home. My son is independent and that would make him very unhappy. I like to think he will have a long and happy life. So when I die, my sisters, women in their 60s and 70s, have agreed that they will take care of my son. I'm very lucky that they have partners who are all happy to welcome him into their family. And I suppose when my sisters die, my son's care needs will fall on their children, and so the cycle continues. My son and these adult children with special needs really are the forgotten people of Ireland.
Now, it is the bank holiday weekend. Maria Burke, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
I'm not too bad now. We were talking to a certain degree yesterday about people who have, you know, sometimes feelings of insecurity or not necessarily safety knocking around Dublin. But you've had a good experience with your daughter. Tell us about your daughter.
Yes. And first of all, I just want to offer my condolences on the death of Sean Rocks, you know, to his wonderful family and to his radio family, because I was an avid listener to the arena and I did note his absence on Monday. So I really want to acknowledge that, Colm, you know, for all of you.
Yeah, well, you're very good. He'll be greatly missed by everybody in here.
Yes,
but
yes, yeah.
Especially, as you say, by his family. But go on, yeah.
Yes. So I was in Dublin there on the 15th of June with my daughter, Abby. We went up to see Chris Hadfield. He was on in the Bord Gáis, A Journey into the Cosmos. And Abby was doing the Leaving Cert, so it was a nice little mini break in between, because she had a big gap before she finished the Leaving, and she wanted to go to Hodge Figgs, the bookstore there on Dawson Street. She loves bookstores. She wants to do, you know, a whistle-stop tour of all the bookstores in Ireland.
Right.
So we went to Hodge Figgs, and what a beautiful store, I have to say. And while we were in there, you know, we were engaging and we were chatting, and the staff are amazing. I have to compliment the staff. They're so fantastic. And as we went up to pay for our books, and we had our books in our basket, this lovely lady must have heard myself and Abby conversing, because she said, I'm leaving the country today. And you know where you get a stamp if you buy so many books?
Oh, yeah, the loyalty card.
The loyalty card, which, you know, we didn't have. We were up from West Cork. So I said, God, you're so kind. Thank you so much. So we got €10 off our books because
Fantastic.
Of that, which was amazing. So then we proceeded over to the George Street Arcade, which I love, you know, off George Street.
Yeah, it's great.
Street.
All the stalls inside. It's secondhand vinyl,
fabulous.
T-shirts,
yeah.
Spices.
Fabulous. Yes. And Abby wanted a T-shirt with Sinead O'Connor, and then she saw another T-shirt and she was there saying, and I said, Abby, which one would you like? There were €20 each. And the lady said, actually, she said, if you want the two, I'll give you the two for 36.
Great.
And I said, oh, my God. Amazing. And we went into the record store opposite. There's a lovely record store and CD store there. And I do tend to chat. I'm sure you noticed that
used to be called Max Records when I was a teenager. I don't know what it's called now.
Lovely.
Yeah.
And I just said to the man behind the counter, I said, we're up from West Cork. We're going to Chris Hadfield. My daughter is doing the Leaving. What a beautiful conversation we had with him. And he was very engaging and asking Abby all about the Leaving. And then we proceeded to get on the bus to go back to South Circular Road to my friend. And I was looking at my hand saying, change wise. And he said, you know what, just give me €2. Well, do you know what, Colm? I sat down and I said to Abby, look at all those beautiful interactions we're just after having. And it was so amazing. And I said, Abby, this is what happens when you stay off your phone and you leave your headphones at home. So So it was just wonderful, Colm.
A bit of human
and
kindness.
And it was really, really lovely.
And she, so she's doing the leaving. She wanted to see Chris Hadfield. Why? She doesn't just want to see him. It's career tips she's after, really, isn't it?
She is. Yeah. Her dream is to work in space and work in NASA. That's her dream. And sure, you know, dream right. big. That's what people tell us. And she's read his autobiography. She knows everything about him. And she wants to go up. And I said, sure, why not?
Right. You've and always encouraged her to dream big, have you?
Dream big, Colm, yeah, absolutely. She was born very premature. She spent 100 days in the neonatal unit. And, you know, just to give a shout out to anybody at the moment visiting their child in the NEO, you will come through this. And this time 19 years ago, we were there, and look at where we are now. So just stay with yourself and stay positive, and good things do happen. And that was a wonderful experience for us in Dublin. And I love Dublin. I used to work in Dublin. Right. And it's an amazing city.
And she's your only child, is she?
She is. Unfortunately, like my mother used to say, God rest her soul, she was hard got. I was in my early 40s having her, but we wouldn't be without her. And it's great. It's lovely. And interestingly as well, Colm, while you're talking about people with learning disability, I have a beautiful brother, Francis, born Down syndrome, and he is in supportive accommodation. So I really resonated with everything that was spoken about this week and what everybody said. And listening to that beautiful lady, Una, oh my God, my heart goes out to her and to everybody who is struggling trying to get a place for to have the care needs of their beautiful sons and daughters and brothers looked after.
Your brother's happy,
very,
is he?
It is very, very difficult. Oh, he's amazing. He's in supportive accommodation in Bandon, you know, and he has 8 siblings who he adores, and he's very, very well looked after. And I thank God for that.
And you'd wish the same happiness for all of the people who are in touch with us, Tony and Marie and Frank and all of those.
And Una. And yeah. I really hope Jennifer Carl McNeil is listening to this, and I really hope the government do something for those families where their loved ones can be cared for, which is nothing less than they deserve, Colm.
Okay. Well, look, maybe we'll be talking to Abby from space at some point. Tell her, feel free to ring into Liveline.
When she's up there, as we speak.
Does she play the guitar?
She tried to play the guitar.
Okay.
She tried, but reading is her thing. But
okay, well, tell
she
her.
Will kill me when she hears I was on, but she is in Portugal, so she won't be hearing.
All right,
this.
We won't tell her. We promise. Right, tell her to practice her David Bowie for when she gets into space. Thanks very much, Maria. We're back in a minute.